You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
The Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Mall, we call it the Crenshaw Mall, is an economic engine for this community.
It matters who owns the mall because everyone has an agenda.
We're in a desert for food. We're in a desert for shopping. And there's no reason we should have to leave our neighborhood in order to spend our money.
The mall sits on the corner of Crenshaw and Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevards, and it symbolizes an investment in Black Los Angeles, where anchor tenants have included Sears, Walmart, and lots of Black-owned businesses. It's also for sale. And anytime something is for sale these days, in this part of Los Angeles, there's the threat of gentrification. The rents keep rising. A Crenshaw Boulevard train line is coming in. This community is changing. And so there's a bold idea percolating on the streets of Crenshaw. People who live here should buy their mall themselves and develop it with Black LA's interests in mind. But can they really do that? And would it really keep money in the neighborhood? KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb covers the business of Southern California, and he picks up the story from here.
If you walk around the Crenshaw Mall these days, especially during the week, you can see that its businesses are struggling. There's a little food court area inside. Only a few tables are set up. Bored-looking security guards click tally counters to add up the few shoppers.
This is no traffic in this mall. This is not the way a mall right now should be looking.
That's Malik Muhammad, and his store is called Malik's Books.
And we've been here serving the community since 1990, serving the community with books and gifts that speak to our diversity and diaspora.
Muhammad says he actually opened up another location in nearby Culver City because business is slow and he just doesn't know what the mall will look like in the future. Plenty of local businesses on nearby streets are actually thriving, but this shopping center, like lots of indoor malls, has fallen on some hard times. It was a novelty when it opened back in the 1940s. More recently, it's lost anchor tenants such as Sears and Walmart. And now it's up for sale, with potential buyers' development plans, including things like luxury housing and office space. City planners envision lots of new apartments for people, too, who can afford market rates and also want to hop on the train to their jobs. It's a troubling vision for Muhammad.
When someone comes in on the outside and got a completely different agenda, it might not be the best agenda for the neighborhood. It might be a plan to gentrify and to uproot and to push out. Okay, that's what a lot of people who come in this neighborhood want to do. They want to push out. So we need to develop our own communities.
Now, that push for community control has already killed two massive bids from real estate investment firms and capital groups. We're talking about offers well over $100 million.
We heard that the plan was to build luxury condos and townhouses here. We knew that we had to draw a line in the sand and really stop that type of gentrification from happening that would be making housing so much more expensive for us.
Nikki O'Cook is leading a community effort to buy the mall, redevelop it, and let the neighborhood profit from its economic revitalization. It's called Downtown Crenshaw Rising, and they've been active, demonstrating in the streets, marching to the homes of would-be developers, and getting together outside the mall itself to share their ideas. Just like recently, with food trucks, a mobile clothing boutique, and live performances, roller skaters danced together to the music on the gray pavement.
We felt it was important to come together, to recognize and to celebrate the fact that we put in our bid for this mall.
That's Baba Akili, a veteran organizer in Los Angeles and also a Black Lives Matter organizer. He's part of the Downtown Crenshaw team that wants to buy the mall and its 870,000 square feet of retail space. Damian Goodman, a prominent activist here too, says community control of the mall could be Crenshaw's shield against the threat of further gentrification.
It's got to be collectively owned. When people have asked us, what are we going to do here? When community members ask that, the response is, sorry, what do you want to see? which in and of itself is revolutionary.
Downtown Crenshaw has a lot of ideas for what this place should look like. A 6-acre park for Black cultural events and entertainment. A housing plan where 80% of the units are affordable housing. A senior center, a daycare center. Things that Goodman says other developers just don't care enough about when it comes to Black neighborhoods.
How do you uplift and not uproot a community, especially a Black community that's undergone so much just difficulty and trauma? This is a food desert. This is, you know, a cancer cluster. This is displacement central in some respects. This is a place that has had a lack of economic opportunity for the existing Black and brown residents. How do you solve all those challenges in one massive project? That's the question, and I think we're answering it.
To do it, they need at least $100 million in investments and financing. Not to mention what they'll need to develop the site afterward. Can they do it? For inspiration, downtown Crenshaw points to a number of places, including the Market Creek Plaza in San Diego. It used to be a 20-acre factory, and now it's a cultural hub where residents have an ownership stake so they're protected from being priced out. But that's a much smaller project than the Crenshaw Mall. And first, downtown Crenshaw's bid has to be selected. So far, it hasn't. Capri Retail Services, which manages the property, declined an interview request for this story. It also refused to answer questions about the mall's occupancy rate, which current tenants say keeps falling. In a statement provided to KCRW, Capri CEO Rachel Freeman says the company is, quote, working with its tenant community on a case-by-case basis to support them, end quote. But as the sale of the mall drags on, there are some Crenshaw residents who fear the activists will just push away development, development the neighborhood badly needs. Folks like Gina Fields, who chairs the local neighborhood council.
I'm extremely concerned that the bigger message that downtown Crenshaw is trying to push will derail this project and cause it to be just a big empty whale carcass sitting in the middle of our community with nothing.
Field says she's seen development plans go belly up in her community too many times. The lot where the newly built Kaiser Permanente sits across the street from the mall, that sat vacant for a quarter century. Field says that Crenshaw just can't afford for that to happen with the mall.
We all support the idealism of downtown Crenshaw. We would hope that they would have the money and the ability to buy the mall. We've just seen no proof of it. The reality is we need something there. We need places to shop. And we need someone who can come in and actually make that happen. And the mall is too big and too important to our community to end up with nothing.
Downtown Crenshaw, for its part, says it does have the money needed to buy the mall. Goodman says the group raised more than $30 million for its most recent bid and that they've offered the most money for the property, though KCRW has been unable to independently verify that information. There are also some big names behind the downtown Crenshaw proposal, including Smith Group, which designed the National Museum of African American History and Culture in D.C. All of this is attractive to residents and business owners like Kim Prince, who runs Hotfield Chicken just outside the mall's main buildings.
I'm grateful that the community has raised its voice and said their piece about what they want to see because they live here. They work here, they play here, they worship here, they get educated here, you know, second, third, fourth generation even now. And, you know, it doesn't have to like come in and change so drastically. The community's not gonna stand for that.
The mall's owners are currently reviewing a third round of bids for the property. Downtown Crenshaw is one of them. And Goodman says if his organization's plan isn't chosen, they're prepared to keep fighting. For KCRW, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb.
Well, coming up, about 40% of LA County is at max vax, fully vaccinated against COVID-19. But the number of folks getting the shots is dwindling. Why? And what can be done to turn that around? That's coming up on the program in just a moment. But first, I want to remind you about KCRW's Drive to the Future, where in these tumultuous times, your support goes beyond public radio. Over the past year, just like the story we heard from Benjamin Gottlieb, you have heard KCRW and Greater LA's reporting on the people and places most affected by the pandemic. And during this drive, a portion of your donation actually supports KCRW's community partners. This week, we're focusing on homelessness. So support KCRW today, and part of your contribution will help provide legal aid for people experiencing homelessness. KCRW.com/give, and together we can build a better future. If KCRW is a part of your daily life, give now. Put a dollar figure to it. KCRW.com/give. And thank you for your support of KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
All right, onward now with this episode of Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Right now, the coronavirus pandemic worldwide is as bad as it's ever been, driven by giant surges in India and South America. But you wouldn't know it from the strides being made here in Southern California. New cases and hospitalizations in LA County are way down, now officially moving the county into the yellow tier, the least restrictive tier. That is great news for the economy. The city and county have a plentiful supply of vaccines. They're offering appointment-free shots at multiple locations. But, and there is a but here, well, a little more than half of all Angelenos 16 and older have had at least one shot. Vaccination rates are now plunging. That is not good news, because if enough people don't get fully vaccinated, the county won't likely reach herd immunity, making it more vulnerable to new outbreaks and new variants of COVID. Barbara Ferrer, PhD, heads up LA County's Department of Public Health. Madam Director, welcome back to you.
Oh, thank you for having me today, Steve.
And Dr. Oliver Brooks. Oliver Brooks, MD, is Chief Medical Officer at Watts Healthcare. Dr. Brooks, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be back with you, Steve.
So, Madam Director, just 4 months ago, our healthcare system was at a breaking point. I mean, we all remember it seemed dire. We're much better now. I dare say better. I mean, it's obviously bad around the world. California, though, has the lowest case rate in the country. We still need a lot more people to get vaccinated, though, right?
Of course. And, you know, the good news is, obviously, we have about 40% of people living in L.A. County that are fully vaccinated. We're probably at slightly over 60% of our residents here have had at least one dose. But that means there's lots of people that still haven't had even their first dose, and many people that have to come back in and make sure they're getting their second dose. I do appreciate, you know, obviously for us, this is millions and millions of people that have come in to get vaccinated. We've administered collectively across the county over 8 million doses. And that's, really a remarkable accomplishment. And I don't want to diminish it in any way by noting that the last couple of weeks, demand for vaccines has dropped considerably. You know, I always think that when you're in, you know, sort of the kind of race we are in to end the pandemic, it's really important to acknowledge that for every individual, there are different priorities in their lives, and there are different considerations that they need to take into account when they make a decision about getting a vaccination. Our job, and I think Dr. Brooks is, you know, sort of a leader in this field, is to make it as easy as possible for people to come in and get the vaccinations, and as easy as possible for them to feel like they have access to good information and to be able to talk to trusted leaders in their community about any of their concerns and to be able to get their questions asked. And that's the work we're doing now. So I feel pretty comfortable that over the next month or two, we will be able to get more and more people to come in and get their vaccines as we make it easier and as we answer their questions.
Well, speaking of trusted leaders in the community, Dr. Brooks, we hear a lot about vaccine hesitancy and vaccine access. We have talked to you. We've had you on the show many times, actually, talking about these issues and the issue of coronavirus in general. I want to start with that vaccine hesitancy. What have you been doing over at Watts Healthcare to overcome it in your community? And what do you think works?
So there are three primary reasons why people have hesitancy or lack of hesitancy to advocate for it. Confidence, the three C's: confidence, convenience, and complacency. The big one right now seems to be confidence in the vaccine. People mistrust the government. They mistrust the pharmaceutical manufacturers, mistrust those that are advocating for it. So what we are doing, first of all, is ensuring people that the vaccine is safe and effective. I work with National Medical Association, African-American physicians, and we put out a statement categorically endorsing the vaccines. The other thing is we make the vaccine readily available. We have vaccine clinics at our health center. We are now open to the public, on the public domain, to vaccinate the public. And we even have expanded hours. We have it on Saturdays. So you make the vaccine readily available. We also will be working with trusted leaders in the community. I've gone on numerous shows like this and spoken and said, categorically, I've been vaccinated, my family's been vaccinated. What we see is that people trust those that are around them. If their friends get vaccinated, if their family gets vaccinated, they are more likely to get vaccinated.
You both have to deal with trust issues all the time, I'm sure. And Dr. Brooks, especially in the Black community, there has been a mistrust of medical officers for many, many years in this country, for obvious reasons, for tragic historic reasons. And Barbara Ferrer, you've had to deal with it too, because we've got a lot of conspiracy theories out there concerning the vaccines in general, the Bill Gates chip, you know, the it's going to change my DNA, stuff like that. Barbara Ferrer, you first. How do you overcome that? How do you overcome the misinformation that's out there?
I think Dr. Brooks, you know, really said it best earlier when he talked about really making sure that trusted leaders in the community have access to good information and that they can then provide that information to people that they're close to or that they're working with. And that's why the network in LA County is so huge. 739 sites are open this week offering vaccinations in hopes that there will be places where people already have established those trusted relationships and they can feel comfortable going in and getting vaccinated or going in and getting their questions answered.
Dr. Brooks, what about the mistrust in communities of color? How are you overcoming that? I mean, given what's been out there for decades.
So you go to the exact concern that a person may have. When you see one hesitant person, you've seen one hesitant person. So for example, if they ask about the government and this Bill Gates chip, say that people are saying that, in my opinion, just to get you not to take a vaccine. So why would you believe that? I am a physician. I am a pediatrician, chief medical officer. I study vaccines. I get the vaccine. My family is vaccinated. Don't let these people fool you. It's like we say, don't go for the okey-doke. And the manufacturers, you know, the manufacturers, they make more money generally on pharmaceuticals than vaccines. And they got this vaccine out very rapidly because we couldn't wait. People worry about, oh, it came out too soon. Oh, what? We're going to wait 3 years for a vaccine and then have 3 million people dead? I say this is a technological miracle, and you're going to walk away from a technological miracle. December 10th, there were 0% of LA County vaccinated, and here we are at what? About 40% fully vaccinated 16 months later. I said, if you're going to look away from that, then you're just looking a gift horse in the mouth.
Dr. Brooks, you mentioned percentages, and Barbara Ferrer, I'll switch back to you because there was this New York Times article that talked about how experts are now predicting that maybe herd immunity in the U.S. is unlikely, but the country can focus on containment. Number one, do you agree that herd immunity is sort of out of reach? Can we reach it here in L.A. County? And number two, you know, what do you do if that doesn't happen? Can we still achieve at least containment if that herd immunity isn't there?
It's such a good question. I think about it a little bit differently. One thing is it's a new virus and a new vaccine. Not really clear exactly what that number will be for herd immunity. And because of that, you know, I tend to focus less on, you know, is there an exact number that we need to reach? The one thing that's really abundantly clear at this point is the more people get vaccinated, the more protection we have, both as individuals once we're vaccinated, but just as importantly as a community. It's really upon all of us to try to do the best we can to get more people vaccinated. Whether we get to 75% or 80%, or, you know, some people say it's 85%, I think what we have to do is continue to make progress. We have to continue to be able to explain to people the importance of this vaccine. And just as you're seeing now, we are already reaping the benefits of having, you know, 40% of people fully vaccinated. You know, that number goes way up when you look at people 65 plus, and that was the population that was hit the hardest. And I think if we continue to make gains on getting more and more people vaccinated, we build that protection. And the most important thing right now is we build protection against having new variants circulating in LA County that may not respond as well to the vaccines that we're using today. So that's the race. The race is to not have new variants cropping up here, not give chances for there to be both a lot of mutations and then the ability to transmit what we call variants of concern.
Barbara Ferrer, there are people, and I've read this online, I have seen it in my Twitter feed and other folks who say, hey, I'm going to get, and this is the opposite side, by the way, of the spectrum. There are people who get the double dose of Pfizer or Moderna, and then after that, they go get a Johnson & Johnson. How dangerous is that? Is it dangerous? Do we know anything about it?
We don't know a lot about it, and there's actually no evidence that gives you any added protection. What we do know is if you're getting Moderna or Pfizer, you need the second dose to be fully protected, and that if you're getting the Johnson & Johnson, you just need that one dose. Johnson & Johnson is equally effective at preventing hospitalizations and deaths, as is the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine. So we would urge people not to go ahead and do that because it's just not necessary.
Dr. Brooks, here we are in the yellow tier starting today. Barbara Ferrer, your department obviously implementing this, saying it's okay as of what, midnight last night or this morning. So here we are, Dr. Brooks, in the yellow tier, least restrictive. The economy is almost fully open, although we're still at certain capacities at restaurants, movie theaters, places like that. I mean, did you ever think we would get here? And do we say, oh, well, the pandemic, I mean, it's really, I mean, it's kind of behind us now.
So clearly the pandemic is not behind us because people are still getting infected, hospitalized, and dying. I think the yellow tier was done scientifically, so it's not just someone decide, I think, let's open up. And if things turn around and rates go up, testing more positive individuals or hospitalizations, then we will move away from yellow. So I think that people need to follow the guidelines. Period. I will say this, though, Steve, I am optimistic. Again, we look at, you know, we're worried we may never get to community immunity. I use that instead of herd immunity. But I'm optimistic. First of all, we got Pfizer coming on board soon with a childhood vaccine for 12 to 15 years of age. And hopefully that gets approved. Those that are affected have some immunity, though they still need to be vaccinated. And then, as Dr. Ferrer said, the highest rate of those vaccinated are those 65 and over. So the concern about coronavirus is infection, hospitalization, and death. All that stuff is down. So I think as we move to yellow tier, we will see some coronavirus, but we will also see life better. As people feel their life is better, that in and of itself may make some want to get vaccinated. As life is better, those that are fully vaccinated will have a certain feeling of confidence, and that'll be exuded on those that aren't vaccinated. So I think that the decision was made appropriately, and I believe in it. I'm fully vaccinated. Obviously, I will follow the guidelines, how it stays so far. If there's a large gathering indoors, I will likely still wear a mask.
Dr. Oliver T. Brooks, Chief Medical Officer over at Watts Healthcare Corporation. Barbara Ferrer, Director of the LA County Department of Public Health. I want to thank you both for coming on today.
Oh, thanks so much, Steve. Always a pleasure.
And thank you, Steve. Keep doing the work you do, getting the word out.
Well, that's going to do it for us today. Next week, neighbors in Lincoln Heights are in a battle over a development in one of the few low-rent areas left in the neighborhood. a trip along Pico Boulevard and how restaurants there now reflect the spirit of former Governor Pio Pico himself. And come along to the bar that only lets you in with a vaccine card. All next week on this program, wherever you are in Greater LA, know that you're an important part of our mission to inform, to help drive the conversation, to educate, to entertain. And KCRW's Drive to the Future is our spring fundraiser that not only benefits KCRW, but also community organizations all around Los Angeles. We're focusing on public health and education and housing. These are issues that have come into focus over the years for sure, but certainly since the beginning of the pandemic. We're actually giving a portion of our proceeds and attention to those causes. And this week, we're focused on homelessness. So support KCRW tonight, and part of your contribution will help provide legal aid for people experiencing homelessness. It's that easy. KCRW.com/give. And thank you again for your support of KCRW. Once again, KCRW.com/give. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, John Meek, Ray Guarna, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Amy Todd, Jody Adler, Mike Vogel, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on the show. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ears. Have a great night.